Alrighty, welcome to another episode of Constructed Resources. This is Constructed Resources number 69, and we're going to be talking about alchemy this week. Of course, I'm Louis Scott Vargas, one of the hosts, and joined on the line by Andrew Backstrom, BK, our other official host. How's it going, BK?
Oh, it's great. You know, it's been a very relaxing week getting settled back in fully. Now it feels like into work and all that, and Magic itself is sort of getting back into the swing of things with the first sort of big event of the year with the Arena Open coming up this weekend.
Yep, and what we're going to do is we're going to kind of give you an overview of Alchemy, talk about some of the Alchemy-only cards that you'll run into if you're playing this weekend. And, you know, if you haven't played any Alchemy and you're interested in getting into Alchemy for the Arena Open, this is the episode for you. If you have played Alchemy, maybe this will help you settle on kind of your final deck choice. So that's what we've got planned for the episode. Of course, before we get to that, we've got to thank our sponsors. This show is brought to you by ChannelFireball.com. Your marketplace and go-to for anything you need magic related, whether that's cards, accessories, magic strategy, Channel Fireball's got it. So head on over to channelfireball.com and check it out. Our other sponsor is FTX. FTX is a marketplace for digital assets, things like cryptocurrency, NFTs, and much more. So you can head on over to FTX.us if you're in the US, or FTX.com elsewise. It's a trusted, safe place to kind of engage with this area of the market. And, you know, it's a great place to go for that. Of course, we are not registered financial advisors. So make sure that you're consulting with those and doing your due diligence before making any investments. All right. So you want to kick things off with a deck of the week?
Yep. So I got a cool deck, a little bit of a blast from the past from Max Attack from this weekend's Modern Challenge, bringing back prowess into Modern. So we're talking about Monastery Swift Spear, Soulscar Mage, and then alongside the MH2 sort of premium one drops in Dragon's Reach, Channeler, and Raghavan. But and rather than, you know, playing with like more removal or, you know, other kinds of interaction like counter spells, we're just sticking with a pretty straight mono-red approach for the most part. And for card draw, we've got things like Light Up the Stage and Reckless Impulse. Obviously, Light Up the Stage we're all familiar with. And Reckless Impulse is a pretty similar card where you get to exile the top two cards of your deck and play them until the end of your next turn. And so this is just, you know, the big restriction here is that you're going to want to be playing with mostly cards that you can use proactively, so you're going to be cutting down on you're not playing in a deck with like Fatal Pushes, Thought Seizes. There are two Prismatic Endings. The deck is splashing white, but like a lot of red aggro decks in the Modern format, it's doing so partially because of the sideboard, where you might want to be able to go into things like Boros Charm to give yourself a little bit more reach. Core Firewalker is of course just phenomenal in any sort of red mirror, and then Path to Exile for a little bit of extra removal against bigger threats. And then, well, of course, yeah, the white splash is also because you have Lure. So the Dream Den is your companion, and so that works really nicely with Mishra's Bauble and all of your one-drop creatures to give you some more resiliency in longer games. And it's another way of rewarding you for being able to hit more land drops with your Light at the Stages and your Reckless Impulses. It's kind of, you know, you both get the advantage of both getting more cards, but also you do a good job of taking advantage of having more lands. Sunbay Canyon, another fantastic option too.
One of the pieces of technology people have been adopting in Modern is Pyrite Spellbomb. And it's to kill Sanctifier Envec and Core Firewalker, Burned and Forge Tender, all of these pro-red creatures, because there's been a pretty big uptick in all of those seeing play, so including in this deck. So not a bad card if for your like Grixis Shadow deck or your Rakdos mid-range deck, or really any red deck that needs a way to deal with these pro-red creatures. So keep an eye on Pyrite Spellbomb. That's one that I think is its stock is rising in Modern, and just seeing these Core Firewalkers reminded me of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is an interesting direction to go back to, just because you get the advantage of having just a lot more cheap threats. And so you don't have to worry about as much of, hey, what happens when your first one dies? And one of the nice things about both Dragon's Rage, Channeler, and Raghavan is they're both good turn one plays, but they're also good one drops for future turns. And so you could play your earlier prowess creatures like your Swift Spears and your Soulscar Mages. And then, man, if that gets killed, well, you dashing in a Ragavan, and that's a great way to keep things going. And because your cards are so proactive in a prowess deck, you have the nice advantages of being able to chain off huge turns with Ragavan's treasures, where you might be able to get really huge prowess hits.
Yeah, I mean, I like the lower curve and Reckless Impulses as a way to kind of present extra aggro, but also kind of outcard people who are looking to be grindy. So pretty cool deck. It was a good highlight.
All right. And then I got a kind of a little bit of a hypothetical EGA, because this one for our EGA of the week, you know, we like to ask a question to mix things up, delve into how you approach some of the more weird situations outside of just the gameplay on the table. But this question's for you, Luis, is let's imagine a hypothetical, like say it's a Grand Prix. Imagine playing in one of those, and your opponent is playing with a companion, and in between games 2 and 3, they don't do any sideboarding. But you also happen to notice when they're like pile shuffling, and the fact that they, when they're getting ready to present, that they don't have the companion like sitting to the side of their deck like they did in games 1 and games 2. If this were you, would you point it out to them? Because inevitably, there's nothing illegal about siding your companion into your deck. It would come after you presented, when it was time to either reveal your companions or during the game when you went to go like retrieve them, that they're going to kind of notice the situation and they're going to get a little hosed by their sloppy presentation there.
Well, you know, if we're being honest, there's points in my career where I wouldn't have said anything, and I would have just like let the you know, chips fall where they will. And if my opponent forgets to put their companion back, that's on them, you know. And I think that it's not unethical or unsporting to just not say anything in that spot, because it's not really your responsibility to make sure your opponent's resolving everything correctly. If your opponent's, you know, sideboarding and they side up to, you know, they accidentally make their deck into a 58 card deck or something, and you notice it, you know, that's, like I said, there's some school of thought would say, hey, that's just on them. And I think, yeah, you're not obliged to go out of your way to prevent that. That said, me now, I would just tell them, hey, you forgot your companion. I don't care enough to really try to win that way. And, you know, it might depend on who I'm playing against, to be honest. Like, for the most part, like, if I was in a Grand Prix, I mean, first of all, if I was at, like, an FNM or any local tournament, 100% I'm going to remind them. That's just, I go there to try to play good games. If I was playing at a Grand Prix, I would remind my opponent, unless I had some, like, I was playing against someone who I really didn't like, or we had some kind of, like, altercation during the match, or if there's someone who's very good and it's just, like, you should know better. But no, I would still just do it unless I actively was like unhappy with my opponent for some reason. I really can't imagine trying to just like, ooh, I hope they present and then I can get them. Cause I just don't, it's hard for me to want to win that way at this point in my career.
How would it factor in if you were, do I want to ask what it would be like if we were playing against each other in a tournament?
I think that one's going to be better revealed if it ever comes up.
Oh God. Yeah, it's. I appreciate you being honest about the question. I think everybody, even a lot, I think your experience is similar to a lot of players, where even people we know now who are relatively friendly players and are pretty generous about being very strict on their opponents and very punishing to them when they make small mistakes. I don't really want to name names, but I know of some players who have very good reputations now that I know, like 6-7 years ago, they were pulling some real stuff in tournaments, stuff you would describe as rules lawyering. And I'm sure, and I know I have some skeletons in my closet situations where I was harsher on opponents than I wish I had been. And so I agree with you. It's I think that kind of stuff, it's at the end of the day, I think not having Magic tournaments around has made us appreciative of like getting to play a real legitimate match of Magic. That's what's always like kind of surprised me about how often people are willing to like split Magic tournaments at the end, and not even play it out. And it's like, what are you signing up for here? I sign up typically, because I like playing matches of Magic, especially ones where it feels like there's really something on the line. It's a thrill I haven't gotten to experience in a while, and I do miss it.
Yeah, and I would hope that we live in a world where people would generally say something there, but I also like understand that not everyone would. And like I said, there's been times where I think neither of us, like there have been positions in our lives where neither of us wouldn't have said or would have said something, you know, depending on what all the circumstances are. And I think anyone who says like, I would absolutely never have done that is like, yeah, maybe, you know, I can't tell you that you're lying, but it's like the whole, everyone says they would return a wallet full of money in it, but it doesn't really matter until you find the wallet full of money.
Yeah, I definitely would return the wallet, and it looks like maybe the money disappeared. No, just kidding. But the one thing to keep in mind, though, with something like this situation is that it does come into that category of like you're offering sort of unsolicited advice. And so one, a pretty reasonable approach to take in Magic tournaments is just like, just worry about your own stuff. And just don't focus on like trying to stop people from making mistakes. It's particularly been an issue over the years when it comes to male players pointing these types of things out to non-male players. And sometimes in situations where, yeah, they knew what they were doing. This one is a little bit less of that, but it is generally a pretty good thing to just not go around throwing unsolicited advice to other people.
Yes, I would generally recommend you not patronize your opponents.
What about your co-hosts?
You know, at a certain level, it's not really patronizing. It's more like explaining. So,
wow.
I can explain more in depth if you didn't get it.
I just got co-host explained. All right. Should we move on to the main topic of the show this week, Luis, the Alchemy in the Arena Open?
Let's do it. So,
do you want to start off by maybe even just explaining to people what Alchemy is in case they missed the brouhaha last December?
Yeah, that was literally what I was going to do. So, Alchemy is a Magic Arena only format. It uses the set of standard card pool plus the set of Alchemy cards. So these are cards only legal in this format. And it also has versions of cards that are slightly different, mostly nerfed. For example, Alrun's Epiphany now costs 7 to play off Foretell and only makes the birds if you foretold it. So stuff like that is really what the difference between Alchemy and Standard is. And what ends up happening is Alchemy as a whole is a more powerful format because whatever is lost by the Standard nerfs is much more than made up for by some of the powerful cards in Alchemy. And I want to talk about a few of the cards. This isn't like an exhaustive list of the good cards in Alchemy. This is more like these are cards you should be aware of if you're going to play, especially if you haven't played Alchemy before, because they can have a pretty big impact and really make it so the format feels quite a bit different than Standard, even though it uses a lot of the same cards. Number one is Divine Purge. So this is a 1WW sorcery. Exile all artifacts and creatures with mana value 3 or less, and they perpetually gain. This spell costs 2 more to cast, and this permanent enters the battlefield tapped. And then as long as they're exiled, the owner may play it. So basically, it's a 3-mana sorcery speed. Exile everything that costs 3 or less, but it eventually can all get replayed. It's just all gotten hit by Elite Spellbinder and Kismet. They all come into play tapped. This can be a pretty effective Wrath, and if you're not used to playing against a 3-mana sweeper in Standard, especially one at this power level, well, Divine Purge is that card. So you got to watch out. Obviously, it's great against tokens. It just gets tokens out of here forever. And it can be really effective out of a deck that has a bunch of 4 and 5 cost creatures like Boros Dragons is where it sees like a decent amount of play because they cast Divine Purge, wipe all your stuff, and then attack you with 2 dragons. So Divine Purge, definitely one to keep an eye out for. And then next we have, I think, the reason that aggro is largely not that good in Alchemy. It's Sanguine Brushstroke. This card's a bit dangerous. It's a 1BB for an enchantment. When it enters the battlefield, you make a blood token and a blood artist. So if you remember blood artist, it's a 0/1 creature from Innistrad, the original Innistrad, that whenever a creature dies, target player loses a life and you gain a life. So it drains your opponent for 1 whenever any creature dies, yours or theirs, which isn't found on that many cards these days. And it also says whenever you sack a blood token, you drain your opponent for 1. So the combo of Sanguine Brushstroke plus ways to sacrifice, ways to generate creatures, ways to remove your opponent's creatures means it can be such a slog trying to get any sort of like ground-based creatures in or really just kill your opponent with smaller creatures. So Sanguine Brushstroke really kind of its presence is felt in the format for sure.
Yeah, it's a super fantastic card. I mean, Blood Artist, it's got a long pedigree and, you know, I mean, just can't emphasize it enough. It works on both sides. It's just not, it's something that they kind of moved away from for the most part with subsequent Blood Artist style of creatures. But the one that people oftentimes, like when they'll talk about Zulaport Cutthroat and they'll even like just shorthand refer to it as Blood Artist, but you get actual factual Blood Artist and another permanent. And one of the big things is just like with some of the, with a card like Sanguine Brushstroke, literally just makes three permanents. And so, you know, when we get to the Orzhov deck, if you're playing with something like Rite of Oblivion, which is asking you to sack a non-land permanent, well, you could just do that with the actual enchantment itself or the blood token. So just it's pretty subtle. It would be easy to round it to like it costs one more mana than Blood Artist, but it's giving you a lot more value than that.
Another card to keep in mind is Town Razor Tyrant. So this is the dragon for two red. It's a 4/4 flyer. And when it enters the battlefield, you make it so one of your opponent's lands first loses all non-mana abilities. So it can make it so your Den of the Bugbear can no longer animate. And they have to take two damage on their upkeep or sacrifice the land. They have the choice, but it's still... this is land destruction at a rate that we're not used to seeing in Standard. And yes, you don't have to lose the land, but Town Razor Tyrant goes pretty deep and, you know, there's a 4/4 flyer in play. How often can you take two damage here? So it's definitely a card that can mess you up. And just remember the text that your land loses abilities. It's text that like, it feels like it's kind of, the card feels complete without factoring that text in. So it's easy to miss when you're playing with Tyrant if that, oh, it just blows up one of their lands, or you're playing against it, and just keep it in mind that it's a good way to shut down lands with cool abilities.
Yeah, and it's, like you mentioned, the ability of like that you could sacrifice to get out of it. It is important to remember that that is like kind of upside in a sense for the opponent, in that it is sort of they get the choice of which world they're living with. So if you don't have any pressure, it could just not affect them and they could just maybe keep taking two for a while. But if they've got plenty of lands, they can easily give one up. So the card is still obviously exceptional, but your opponent does have a lot of agency, and it's important when you're playing against Town Razor Tyrant that you do a good job of making the right choices here. When you know, you don't want to be stubborn and hold on to a land longer than you should. Sometimes you're just going to have to give up on that expensive card in your hand.
Another big one here, and this is one of the things that drives control decks, is a Key to the Archive. So it's a 4-mana artifact. It enters the battlefield tapped, and you can tap it for 2 mana in any combination of colors. The reason that's important is it also says when it enters the battlefield, you draft a card from its spellbook and then discard a card. And so what that means is when you play Key to the Archive, you're presented with 3 cards. You get to choose one, put in your hand, and then discard a card. So you're not up a card, but it is really important to know what your control opponent could have. So first of all, if you're playing against someone who plays Key to the Archive, just Google Key to the Archive spellbook. You can take a look at all the things. You can also highlight or zoom in on the card and like scroll through the spellbook. But I find it easier just to have a list. Some notables there, there's Counterspell, Crows and Grip, you know, destroy target artifact or enchantment, unrespondable split second. Putrefy, destroy an artifact or creature, Lightning Helix and Electrolyze as burn spells, Time Warp, Day of Judgment. So like there's some serious cards and some cards that you really want to know about, like sweepers and counterspell and split second cards to keep in mind when your opponent has gone to the archives, because you have no way of knowing what they pulled out of the archive before they play it.
Yeah, and Key to the Archive is just very reliable in the sense that like fully half of the cards that you can get off of Key to the Archive are just removal. I mean, literally Lightning Bolt and Lightning Helix. Something that is very important to keep in mind with Key to the Archive, though, is that obviously it comes into play tapped, and there's no kind of like weird exception because you got it from the spell book that you don't have to have the right colors for it. So, the Key to the Archive is a 5-color mana source, but if it does get blown up by the opponent and you do take something like an Electrolyze and, you know, you're just playing with like a blue-white deck or an Esper deck, well, there's no guarantee that the Key to the Archive is going to be able to take it. So you might want to be a little bit more careful and take something that you can actually cast off of it reliably, even if the Key to the Archive gets blown up, and be familiar as best you can with what it might be in your opponent's deck list and if they're playing a color combination that gives them access to disenchants.
I watched Nassif pull a Putrefy out of his Key to the Archive and then to blow up the opponent's key, and then they blew up his Key to the Archive, and he could never cast the Putrefy. It was great. I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Yeah, a bunch of the cards, if you're playing in it, like one thing that you can do is if you're playing blue-white or Esper, you could play something like Zagoth Triome in your deck to give you increased access, or be playing with Pathways to give you access to those extra colors just in case.
Yeah, clearly don't do that. Really bad idea. So the last card I wanted to mention was
that. I'm sorry. That's only for Alchemy Historic. Just to be clear, you can for the Triumphs, they have rotated out of both Standard and Alchemy Standard.
Of course,
I guess. Yeah.
Forsaken Crossroads is the last card. This is a land that enters the battlefield tapped. When it enters the battlefield, you choose a color. It taps for a mana of that color. So it's a come into play tapped. You know, any color land. But it also says, when it enters the battlefield, scry one, but if you weren't the starting player, if you went second, you can untap it instead. So I like that the word is designs going, which is if you are on the draw, then it's slightly better. But yeah, it's not a reason to be on the draw. Like, it's decks play this card because it's a good way to make sure your colors are right. It is worth noting that when you're on the draw, you have the option between playing it untapped and scrying. And when you're on the play, it's just a temple. It comes into play, taps, scries one, and gives you any color. So it's a powerful land. It's definitely worth playing and has a little bit of a decision point to it when you go second and you get the option of untapped or scry, and you can kind of just decide later. You don't have to decide from the beginning here.
Yeah. But definitely one of the best new lands. I mean, this is like sort of, in a lot of ways, this land is very similar to an Evolving Wilds, but it's one of the best ones that we've ever seen. I mean, the fact is that you even see just straight two color decks playing this land in the format, just because that functionality of being a turn one untapped duel is really potent for some of the decks like the Orzhov deck, which does have cheap black one drops, but also wants to make sure it has enough white mana. And this land actually does that. And when you're on the draw and you need that tempo against something like aggro, it does give it reliably.
All right. So those are some Alchemy cards that we wanted to highlight just because they do change how you play and they contribute to the texture being very different from Standard. But let's get into some of the decks, because there's a bunch of different solid decks in Alchemy. There's no like one choice that I think, hey, you got to play this deck. But, overall, I think that where I'd want to be is generally not aggro because of Sanguine Brushstroke, like I mentioned before. But if you want to play aggro, you certainly can. Let's start by talking about, well, mono black, because this is, I think, part of the reason not to go down the aggressive route. So this is kind of like mono black snow control, because it's using Blood on the Snow, so it might as well play a bunch of snow covered lands. And it uses like Meat Hook Massacre as a sweeper, and has four Sanguine Brushstrokes, four Cursebound Witches. This is another nice one. This is a one mana 1/2 black for a 1/2. And when it dies, you draft a card from its spellbook. So you can end up pulling a bunch of like sacrifice themed cards, including it has Cauldron Familiar and Witch's Oven. So you could maybe eventually assemble the whole thing there if you want.
Yeah, you got to be really greedy to take Cauldron Familiar first. I would guess that you're going to end up, if you're playing right, you're going to end up getting that combo way more often, because you take Witch's Oven first, and then the Witch's Oven is actually pretty nice, and it does help you like at will sacrifice things like your Shambling Gas and future copies of Cursebound Witch and Eye Twitch. And one of the reasons why is just you can make it so that even when your opponent has exile effects, you still reliably get to trigger it, and you get to do things like it combines nicely with your Lulz, if you get one of those down.
Yeah, one of the cards that I've never seen so many Trespassers curses as as recently, because it's one of the things you can get off the Witch. This is that the curse that drains them for whenever they play a creature. So it's definitely a thing. That
you get them coming and going when you got that one on a Blood Artist.
Oh yeah, no, that card's excellent. And it uses like Fellstinger, like you mentioned, Lolth, Shambling Ghasts, Deadly Dispute. So it's kind of just like a mono black sack deck that has more control elements. It's pretty solidly mid-range and really does tend to step on aggro decks. If you don't mind grindy games, this is a solid choice for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's way more options for this deck than you have slots. I mean, one of the better card draw spells that we've seen in recent years is Deadly Dispute. I mean, just giving you the ability to both sacrifice one of your artifacts or creatures, giving you two cards, and then giving you that treasure that can accelerate you up into getting down a bigger Meat Hook Massacre, getting down Lolth. There's just a bevy of options for you. And yeah, this deck is super solid. The biggest disadvantage that it just has in the format is just that it's pretty much just going to be winning a very slow, grindy game. And if somebody, you know, flies overhead, they've got a real chance to just sort of beat you down, because it does a very good job of locking up the ground, but it's really relying on like those sort of on the ground, on the table synergies, and it's not going to do as well interacting with flyers or spells.
And it's the kind of deck that has a lot of little intricate synergies and timing things and combos, where it's not the deck I would recommend you pick up if you haven't played this style of deck or decks like this, because there is a version of this deck in just normal standard. So if you're familiar with that and this is the kind of gameplay you like, this is obviously a fine choice. But if not, this is not like the level one deck that I would recommend people pick up.
Next deck, Luis, is pretty similar. The Orzhov version of this, of the sort of the black control archetype. And you get a couple of great cards when you go into a second color for white. My favorite is Rite of Oblivion, which is just black and white. You get to exile target non-land permanent. It's an additional cost. You have to sacrifice a non-land permanent, and then it has flashback for two white and a black. And so just a fantastic removal spell, but it does rely on you actually like doing the thing. And if you ever sort of get caught with too many of them, that can be an issue, but there's really no shortage of good sacrifice creatures to play in these decks. And with cards like Wedding Announcement and Edgar Charmed Groom, you even have additional ways in longer games to churn out more creatures and more tokens.
Yeah, getting Rite of Oblivion is the biggest reason to go Esper here. But Edgar Charm Groom and Wedding Announcement are not bad as well.
Yep. One thing to keep in mind, by the way, just with a deck like this that is playing with like Eye Twitch, and one of the things you'll have to be thinking about this weekend is that decision about whether or not you're going to play best of one or best of three. Day two will be best of three. But in best of one, you can only play with a 7-card sideboard. But you won't actually need it unless you're playing with something like Eye Twitch. And so it's one of the things you want to make sure you do is adjust your deck accordingly. And a card like Eye Twitch is certainly a lot more attractive in best of one, where you get to play with the full suite of potential sideboard cards. Whereas in the best of three version, that's going to be coming at more of an opportunity cost, of course, is, you know, maybe you don't want to be playing with Expanded Anatomy.
Well, day two of the Arena Open is going to be best of three. So whatever you pick for that day, you know, you'll have to do that. Though, of course, you could play best of one on day one. Deck that I think is a better choice if you haven't played tons of Alchemy is it or Boros Dragons. This is actually the deck I play the most, various forms of dragons, with Is It being my favorite. And you're basically trading on the fact that Fearsome Whelp is one of the best cards in Alchemy. It's a 1 and a red for a 1/1 flying dragon. At the end of your turn, all dragons in your hand get 1 cheaper forever. So 1 colorless cheaper. So, you know, you play that on turn 2. And turn 3, you can play like a Town Razor Tyrant. But more, you know, than that, it's like, yes, you can play that Town Razor Tyrant on turn 3, but it also now makes your Goldspan Dragon 2 cheaper if it's lived for 2 turns. And it just keeps going from there. So a really powerful card if it isn't killed, and it can stack up to like where it's saving you 2-3 mana every single turn it's in play. Of course, once you reduce a dragon down to just colored symbols, it stops getting reduced at that point. But it's a good deck, whether you play the white cards, like, you know, like I mentioned, Divine Purge is a pretty good reason to go Boros, for example, though Expressive Iteration and Imrith Desert Doom are good reasons to go blue. Dragons is got a lot of powerful cards, and it can kind of go over the top of some of these strategies, though it is kind of vulnerable to Doomblades, and well, there's a decent amount of Doomblades in the format.
Yeah, yeah. I really like how Adult Gold Dragon just helps insulate you against sort of those longer games against the black decks where they're going to drain you a lot, and just getting one or two hits with that 4/3 flying haste lifelink will be able to push you out of range. And Orb of Dragonkind is a really fantastic card, just you know, like you mentioned, giving you another accelerator. Chandra Dress to Kill is a card that works pretty well in the format right now and is really good against those black strategies. By just giving you another hard to kill permanent, if you're up against mono black, it's not like they actually have that many cards which are killing planeswalkers directly, and their creatures are really pretty small. So you get both the best of both worlds, and that it's going to accelerate you into your gold spans and adult gold dragons earlier, but then also give you a way to continue to gas back up if they're trying to grind you out with deadly disputes plus removal spells.
One of the biggest reasons to stick to nearly mono red, whether that's a light splash or no splash, is Chandra. You want to increase the percentage of red cards in your deck. Overall, if you expect more aggro, I think that the red-white version is quite a bit better than the blue-red version, but I do think the blue-red version is better against control decks. So my guess is if you were going to play best of one, you should play the Boros Dragons. But if you end up making day two or just want to play best of three, I think that the Is It version is going to be better for the field. I suspect there's going to be more of the decks where you'd want blue cards, especially with sideboarding, than white cards. Though Divine Purge is kind of nice against like these mono black decks. It can actually do something against all their like random assorted little pieces of garbage.
Yeah. I mean, that is true. They are reliant on actually some of their creatures living, just not most of them. But yeah, Divine Purge is really fantastic card and just one of the premier removal spells in the format. And I guess we could start talking about that one now because it is really one of the backbone cards that makes blue-white X control tick, whether it's Esper or Azuri's control. Just exiling all artifacts and creatures with mana value 3 or less, they perpetually gain the spell cost 2 more to cast. And so it deals with a lot of different problems that you might be working against. It does allow your opponent to potentially get them back eventually, but you can go pretty big in these decks. And if you're playing with Lier, Disciple of the Drowned, well, the perpetually gain the spell cost 2 more to cast, that can keep stacking up. Just because the card costs 2 more to cast doesn't mean its mana value is now 3 or higher. And the second time that your opponent is having to pay an additional 2 is going to be pretty backbreaking for them.
Yeah, these blue-white base decks really are making their money off of Lier and Teferi, who slows the sunset, and Key to the Archive. The combo of Teferi untapping Key to the Archive because as your artifact is huge. And it's the sort of thing that lets you use the card you get off Key right away. If you go like turn 4 Teferi, turn 5 Key, or you play the Key first, play Teferi, and it's like almost like a Hero of Dominaria or Lotus Field, where it didn't cost you almost any mana to get into play. I would struggle to want to play a blue based control deck that didn't have white. I know that there's like Dimir or Is It out there, but so far those have seemed to be quite a bit worse to me than getting access to Teferi and Divine Purge. And I don't think that you should play a control strategy without Key to the Archive. That card is just so good. It's mana ramp, it's mana fixing, and it just provides you this like inconsistent to some degree combination of finishers, removal, tutors, counters, card draw. Like you don't always get the thing you want, but you often enough get something that's worth it, that makes it a card I'm really interested in having. And I think Azorius or Esper control is a great choice for this weekend.
Yeah, the end games for these blue white decks is just so powerful that you get to do things like play with a bunch of copies of Fading Hope and Divide by Zero and just take advantage of even just playing with bounce spells. And that's sort of one of the things to watch out for with playing some of the aggressive strategies, even against blue control, is there's a lot of bounce running around right now and a lot of just stuff on the ground. So if your cards aren't coming in and being impactful in some way right away, don't expect them to still be there and don't expect them to have an easy time getting through. You're like a lot of Magic constructed formats, it ends up being that you got to kind of have things which make a big impact, allow you to gain a tempo advantage. Otherwise, you are going to fall behind.
You know what's gross? The cards you get off of Key to the Archive aren't fake cards. They're actual cards.
Right.
Lier can replay these Lightning Helixes and Putrefies out of your graveyard, and it can just be disgusting in a long game.
Yeah, and if you start getting regrowths going with Lier, well, okay, well, actually, that's no. but yeah, it's a fantastic either Azorius and Esper Control are both great. The biggest thing that you get from going into black is you do get access to Vanishing Verse, and so you'll be a little bit better against hard-to-kill permanents because you get to straight-up exile them.
As for whether you want to play Esper or Azorius, it's close. I would lean towards Esper. I think the removal options are good, and Forsaken Crossroads really does take away some of the sting of being three colors. It's just such a powerful land. So I would lean towards playing Esper, but Azorius is, I think, a pretty reasonable choice as well.
Yeah, and this is a deck that will be definitely more popular on day number two. That it's generally the way that things go with controlling strategies is, you know, a combination of your deck not quite lining up quite right in game number one and people wanting to get through their runs a little bit faster, best of one being overall a more popular way to play, just ends up being that you don't see these types of decks as often. But, you know, you don't want to be too reactionary to what you see on day one. I would expect to run into this deck a lot on day two at the very least.
Yeah, one of the things that I would tend towards recommending as I played through a lot of these arena opens is, if you can bias a little bit towards being good against control, that's usually a good idea. It's not always the case, but deeper in the tournament, that's just where a lot of the players, you know, who are going to be. So, you know, just keep that in mind. I just think this weekend you're going to see a good amount of control decks. And if you happen to be good against them, that's probably going to be good for you. Of course, if someone really has a good run with aggro or just a lot of people choose to play it, that won't necessarily play out that way. But in playing Alchemy and looking at what people are playing, I suspect you're going to see a little more Key to the Archives than you will cheap attackers. And part of it is the Sanguine Brushstroke decks make the aggro decks worse, and then the control decks have a pretty good game against like mid-range decks that are trying to do that. So we'll see where people end up. But I really like playing Esper or Azorius, and my guess is preparing for those decks will pay off.
All right, so let's talk about what is probably the best. I think this is the best aggressive deck in the format, but it's the only aggressive deck I've tried out in the format, and it's Mono Green Aggro. And so this, obviously, it shares a lot of lineage with the standard version, and so a lot of the mainstays that we've become used to, it's a snow-based, so we've got Blizzard Brawls and Kazandu Mammoths and Old Growth Trolls, Ranger class. But Alchemy's given this card a few new options to consider. The biggest one is Tenacious Pup, which is just a 1-mana 1/1. And the next time you cast a creature card, that creature is going to pick up permanently +1/+1. You gain a life and you're also getting a trample and vigilance on it. And so that's a really nice thing to be giving to something, you know, like Kazandu Mammoth, which doesn't natively have trample, but can obviously have some turns where it gets pretty big. One of the other interactions that you really appreciate if you're playing the best of one version is with Grizzled Huntmaster. Maybe the sizing of your creatures, maybe the tempo a Tenacious Pup gives you isn't that valuable. And Grizzled Huntmaster, which is that, it was the most talked about Alchemy card, I think. It's the 3-mana 4/3 that allows you to sort of discard or exile one of the cards from your hand and then cards from your deck and then draw a card from your sideboard. And again, you get that sort of best of one interaction of, well, this is a way to access your sideboard. So you could just fill it up with 7 different bullets for you to access and go everything from Froghemoths to Averbrook Caretakers, whatever you might need, you can put in there for your deck. And this deck is super solid. And if you've liked playing mono green decks in the past, the new tools that Alchemy's given it are definitely worth a bunch.
Yeah, mono green has some good options. It plays out fairly similarly, like you mentioned, to the standard version, but there are some new twists, and there's something to going big enough and making your creatures hard enough to kill, especially with, you know, snakeskin veils, that Sanguine Brushstroke doesn't get you as badly as it would otherwise. So there's that. There are other aggro decks in the format. There's red green werewolves and vampires as well. These are both decks that kind of tribal-ish decks that are two colors, so they're losing a little consistency there, but they do present a pretty fast clock. One of the things that the vampires deck gets to do is just play tons and tons of vampires that get value and just hope that they're hitting their opponent every turn. It's not something that they can guarantee, but when they do, they get to go off with, like, you know, Florian gets to get better and the vampire socialite. So there's definitely something to be said for playing these decks, but I have not been impressed by how vampires plays out. Werewolves has looked a little better. Have you had experience against either of these?
No, I haven't. The one card that looks the most exciting to me, that I was debating between whether I was going to put together Andrea Mengucci's Werewolves deck or Paula's Mono Green deck. And the one card I was kind of interested in playing with was Rahilda, which it's like a Robber the Rich variant. It's when it's a 2-mana 2/2 first strike. When it deals combat damage to a player, you exile a non-land card from their library at random. And then during your turn, if you attack with a wolf or werewolf, you can cast that card and spend mana or mana of any color to cast that spell. And then it has Daybound and the Nightbound side. It's the same thing, except it has double strike. And so this card does give you the ability to sort of pick up some things off of the opponent and give you that sort of a long game flexibility. And then it also partners quite nicely with something like Halana and Alina partners, where you have a way to be able to give it haste in the mid game, and potentially if you get flipped over into Nightbound, you can get a really huge turn with it, and that seemed pretty attractive to me.
Yeah, Rahilda's a real card. I mean, I played with that card in Mono Red, and then played against it plenty, and it that card is a beating. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not going to be casting any Vampires or Werewolves this weekend. I'm not sure if I'm going to be casting anything this weekend because I don't know if I'm playing yet, but if I were, it would not be with Vampires or Werewolves.
Yeah, yeah. What I assume it's because you're going to be watching the NFL wildcard games this weekend.
What?
sports ball, yeah, of course. All right, should we talk anything else that decks we want to touch on? There's also, of course, like in any format, there's Mono Red. Like in most formats, I give it as much consideration in this one.
Yeah, I've mentioned Sanguine Brushstroke before, right? Mono Red really does not like to see that card. And overall, I haven't found a justifiable reason, like a compelling reason to play Mono Red over one of the other aggro decks if you wanted to play aggro, and certainly not over playing one of the other decks in the format like Dragons or Control. If you play against Mono Red, Adult Gold Dragon does some good work, though.
Yeah, that Tauros Disciple card is not a good card.
No, that's the 3/3 haste that shuffles 3 lightning or 4 lightning bolts into your deck.
Yeah.
Lightning bolt's not that good if you draw it on like turn 9 or whatever.
I know.
It's just not. So
yeah. Yep, but it's cute. But it's like one of those things where it's where like people like to make the argument about how, you know, it's well, it's like, well, it's got a good floor because it's a 3-mana 3/3 haste, and it's like you could do better than that. I mean, look at the cards like in the werewolf deck. Look at the 3-drops that they get to play with, and then tell me that you're like happy getting like a 3-mana 3/3 haste.
Totally. So to put you on the spot, if you had to pick a deck right now, what would you play this weekend?
I would play one of the Key to the Archives decks, but I guess I would just I would play with Esper because Vanishing Verse looks pretty nice. I really like the fact that you have additional answers to some of the monocolored planeswalkers like Chandra and Lolth. But I can't say I feel that confident. But Key to the Archive has seemed like just a ridiculous card, and that would be the way I would want to be playing with that card this weekend.
I mean, just you play against these like mono black mid range or Orzhov control decks, and you just spike, you know, Approach of the Second Sun off Key to the Archive, and what do they do? Yeah, I, you know, at the risk of offering the same advice, I would play Esper for the same reasons you stated. I think Key to the Archive is an awesome card. I think that getting Vanishing Verse is really important. And I also like having access to things like Duress. You know, when you're talking about the difference between Esper and Azorius, playing the Mirror Duress and hitting their Key of the Archive before they can play it, or their Teferi before they can play it, or you're both sitting there with untapped mana, six lands in play, Duress is the perfect way to kick that off, because you get to not only take maybe their counterspell or their answer card, but you also get to see what they have in a control mirror that can really impact how you end up playing things out. I think...
Yeah, there is the argument that, like, if you're are experienced and you have good intuitions based upon your opponent's plays, what cards they're likely holding, Duress isn't as valuable. So that's something to consider for those of us who need like the extra security of actually knowing instead of just trusting their gut.
Yeah, I suppose that is a sequence of words you could say.
come on, you've definitely felt that before. I'm not saying it's not like I'm being a little bit facetious, but you always have to play around the range of what your opponent has. And if you are paying a good attention, you can narrow that range down.
I mean, that's definitely true, but there's something to be said for like knowing versus, you know, making any assumptions. Yeah. And Duress knowing that they can't do X or they have access to Y is really, really important, especially on a critical turn. If I were to rate these decks, I do think the best aggro deck, if you wanted to play aggro, is mono green. I think the best control deck, if you want to play control, as we just discussed, is Esper. If you wanted to play mid-range, that one's tough. Like, I think Boros or Is It Dragons are a fine choice, but I also think that you could definitely get a lot of value off playing Mono Black or Orzhov. The main argument against those, I think, is they are the trickiest to play, and if a lot of people are playing Key to the Archive decks, I don't love their matchups. I think that's something that's going to be a little bit problematic for them.
Yeah, that's legit. All right, so, do you like playing, when you play in these kind of events, Luis, do you like playing best of one on day one, or do you like playing best of three?
It kind of depends. When I play Limited, I almost always play best of one because it does seem to be quite a bit faster. When I play Constructed, I just don't really enjoy best of one Constructed all that much. So I tend to play best of three, even if sometimes it can take longer. Plus, here's an additional advantage. Here's my pitch for playing best of three and Constructed Arena opens on day one. You're going to play best of three on day two. You're just getting more reps and practice for A, the deck you're probably planning on playing, and B, what the field looks like and helps you make good decisions. Whereas in Limited, it doesn't matter because, you know, you don't choose a deck. And when you have to play best of three, you already kind of know what's going on versus playing best of one. They're so similar. But in Constructed, there's such a big difference between the two that I think that you can actually get some real value by playing best of three on day one with the Constructed deck that you're planning on using.
Yeah, that's a fair point. In fact, it was the thing I always say about this. So you said it as well as I could have have in the past.
I would say I said it better, but yeah.
All right. So good luck to everyone this weekend. I guess there's a possibility we'll both be entering in depending upon how this weekend goes. And if so, we'll follow us both on social media, which obviously you should do anyway, but we'll be posting updates there about it if we do end up playing. What do you think the chances are you're going to end up playing this weekend, Luis?
Not particularly high. Just have not an abundance of time, and this is going to be a busy weekend, I think. So that those are all strikes against it. Plus, if it was a limited open, I would play it for sure. But I haven't found a deck that I love so much that I'm like compelled to play. I do. The Esper decks are cool, but I'm not like, got to play this weekend.
Santi giveth and Santi taketh away, as they say.
Yeah, he more giveth than taketh away. And, you know, cause I've changed some diapers, but, that'll of course do it for this week. And, you know, I want to thank our sponsors, channelfireball.com. You can go there to get all your alchemy. Well, no, you can't get alchemy cards there. You can go there to get every card you need for Paper Magic. There's a lot of cool cards and a lot of cool formats to explore. So definitely worth doing. That's again, channelfireball.com. It's a marketplace, has everything you need. And FTX, if you, speaking of marketplaces, you want to buy, sell, and trade, you know, digital assets, cryptocurrency, NFTs, anything along those lines. FTX is where you want to go. FTX.com outside the US and FTX.us inside the US. that'll do it for this week. Thanks for listening.
So, you know, I know we shout out CFB at the beginning of the show, but they picked up some talented writers and enjoyed a couple of articles that I wanted to shout out real quick. I really enjoyed Arnie Hauschenbeth. He's been a fantastic player over the past couple of years who's really on the rise, and he wrote a really great guide to Esper control that I would recommend checking out on CFB Pro. I also really enjoyed reading Hayu's take on how to make Magic more approachable and I guess sort of welcoming for players who, you know, are less common backgrounds and particularly non-male players, and just some really common sense stuff, but some stuff that gave me a new perspective on that. So this CFB does sponsor this show, but they didn't pay me to shout this stuff out, but I really enjoyed both of those articles this week. So make sure you go to channelfireball.com to check both of those out and more articles, because obviously, of course, there's still a lot of fantastic other writers, Reed, Martin, Andrea Mengucci. So any articles you've seen on CFB in the past week that you want to shout out, Luis?
I'm a big fan of basically anything Reed writes. He does a great job. His deep dives, I think, are among the best content on the site. Like, he does these deep dives on a certain deck, certain formats, or sometimes certain cards. One of his classics is like a deep dive on Thoughtseize or a deep dive on Shark Typhoon. These are just really fun articles, and I love the deep strategy articles. So definitely Reed has my vote.
Has anyone written the deep dive on Expressive Iteration yet?
I don't think so, but it didn't seem like that would be very long.
All right. We'll see you next week, and good luck to all the listeners out there this weekend in the Arena Open. And if you win and because of this podcast, 10% tip to the podcast host is customary and very much expected. No. Enjoy your winnings, and good luck, everyone.